Hello, I'm Andy Burnham and welcome to Sparks. This week, in-car audio design, tuning tips for the Vega Selena radio, Poland's first independent TV station on a shoestring, no escape from the global telephone, and we look at radio in Italy and elsewhere, and the latest on the cross-field antenna, revolutionary design or completely useless cylindrical piece of metal. Sparks, we'll find out. Along with your letters, that's this week. In Electronics and Wireless World, a letter about the cross-field antenna, an apparently astonishing invention, which was published by Wireless World 2 or 3 years ago. This letter's from Alan Boswell in Chelmsford. The correspondence on the cross-field antenna has rumbled on for long enough.
I told Mr. Hatley, its inventor, in 1987 that it would not be credible until proper measurements had been made to establish what its typical radiating efficiency was. These measurements were needed because current physics shows that the radiation efficiency is probably small. That is to say, any given effect claimed for the CFA could probably be produced using a much less powerful transmitter and an efficient antenna. In the intervening years, a lot of hype has appeared in this magazine in praise of the CFA, and a few letters urging caution. Not once have you printed the essential quantity required to judge the antenna, which is the field strength produced at a known distance when a known RF power is input to the antenna. At this year's International Conference on Antennas and Propagation, a paper was presented on the CFA, giving the field strength as 2 volts per meter at a distance of 500 meters from the CFA, measured in an area of good ground conductivity in the Nile Delta region of Egypt. At last, a figure has been published that would give an idea of the CFA's efficiency. Simple theory shows that this level of field at this distance can be produced by transmitting from a quarter-wave monopole antenna radiating 10.1 kilowatts. In the trade, it is known that a quarter-wave monopole for medium-wave broadcasting can usually achieve 90% efficiency, and we therefore arrive at the results that 12 kilowatts of transmitter with a quarter-wave monopole will easily produce, in practice, the field claimed for the CFA in the ICAP paper. The paper does not give the input power to the CFA, but the nominal transmitter power was, wait for it, 60 kilowatts. On the assumption that 60 kilowatts was delivered to the CFA, its radiation efficiency was in the region of 20%. This in itself is higher than I suspect is being achieved, and considerable allowance must be made for tolerances in the measurement technique, which is not described, and radiation from the feeder, which is probably significant. Plenty of radio amateurs, myself included, would be able to produce better efficiency at HF with the traditional piece of wire bought for £5 from Woolworths than these results quoted for the CFA. In medium wave broadcasting, for any given application, one has to decide on the required transmitter power and antenna efficiency by trading off the antenna efficiency against the cost of a high power transmitter. A cheap, inefficient antenna will require a powerful and expensive transmitter. The optimum usually occurs with antenna efficiencies of 60 to 90%. The economics, therefore, make the CFA an unlikely candidate for any application below 30 MHz. I strongly advise anybody contemplating the purchase of a CFA to make sure before ordering that the product carries proper certification by a competent agency, that its radiation efficiency has been measured, and that the results of the test is stated. An additional test essential for personal safety is determination of the exact intensity of the fields in the region near the antenna. You would require adequate testing for a microwave oven or a vacuum cleaner, and it is perfectly possible to be equally scientific about antenna measurements. On the theoretical side of the argument about the CFA, it should be said that the physical interpretation of Poynting's theorem of 1884 has always been problematical and liable to error. Poynting's theorem makes no statement about the direction in which energy flows, because the three major terms in his equation are all scalars. The theoretical basis for the CFA, Poynting vector synthesis, is therefore non-existent. It is also ridiculous to claim, as the CFA's inventors have done, that rewriting Maxwell's equations the other way round will allow important new ideas to be deduced. The equations of applied mathematics don't work like that. They simply state that the quantity on the left equals the quantity on the right, without implying anything about cause and effect. It is also, in my view, wrong to claim that the H field plates in the CFA produce significant H fields close to the antenna. What is true is that both pairs of plates will produce E fields and H fields. When the field equations are solved for the regions near the CFA, it is most likely that the H fields near the antenna will turn out to be insignificant. The experiment described in March 89, Wireless World, by Cabery, Hatley and Stewart to investigate this effect is entirely spurious, because the RF driving voltage is wrongly applied. To sum up, I would say that the CFA is a typical inefficient small antenna. Nothing magic is happening, and when the hype is stripped away, we are left with very little. Is it unreasonable to request that no more articles appear on this device until the radiation efficiency can be reliably measured? Without this, anything else is a waste of your reader's time. I notice with pleasure that your August edition contains a letter on time machines. This holds the promise of plenty of material in months to come that is cranky, entertaining, and undoubtedly more academically respectable than the crossed field antenna. A splendid letter there in Electronics and Wireless World by Alan Boswell from Chelmsford in Essex. We have additional information about the CFA. We've seen a photograph of how it was actually tested in these tests in Egypt. An astonishing story. There's a transmitter hut which is 1 kilometre away from a vertical normal medium wave monopole aerial. The aerial is fed by a 5-wire open wire feeder. That's one piece of wire in the centre and 4 wires as a box around it, forming an open wire coax feed. And that just crosses the desert on poles to the normal aerial. In the tests comparing the CFA with this vertical monopole, what the inventors of this device have done is disconnect the inner wire of this 5-wire feeder, run it up to the top of the transmitter building on which they sit the CFA, and then connect the wire to some kind of matching unit and to the aerial. Of course, the wire rising from ground level to the top of the building acts as some form of vertical MF radiator. Quite astonishing. Complete load of rubbish. The man's a charlatan. He should be stripped of his IE membership.
So, our verdict, yes, it is a completely useless cylindrical piece of metal, or even two pieces of metal. This man also manufactures the Dipole of Delight. And Wit Radio Facts don't recommend you rush out and buy his products. Well, from the totally insane to someone very sensible indeed. Paul Burnett, a listener, from Eston in Cleveland. I've just returned to shortwave listening after an absence of 5 years, and being a fan of clandestine stations for many years, how nice it is to receive your station, Radio Facts. I got to hear your station after reading the off-the-record page in Shortwave magazine, and decided to tune in. Being an electrical engineer and a radio ham, I like the Sparks programme broadcast on Mondays. My receiving equipment up here in Teesside is a low SRX30 receiver and a 20-metre long wire running north-south with no ATU. Keep up the good work. I back you all the way, and I'll be listening to you in the future. Thanks, P. Burnett.
You. a man. You got to understand, she don't mean to make the scene. Like you, she feels all the weight you're under. And when she breaks, is it any wonder? I know sometimes it crosses your mind to get on out and stay hard to find. Before you try, you'd better look in her eyes. Love is forever. Stay together.
Apart with VHS in international broadcasting. VHS and Amstrad receivers power Poland's first private broadcaster, reports Andrew Emerson. While many Western consumers use VHS technology as a plaything in their leisure hours, there are some strapped broadcasters for whom it is the very stuff of their business. In the newly liberated countries of Eastern Europe, there are many ambitious plans for expanding the broadcasting horizons from the stilted, state-controlled stodge of the past. Their budgets, however, scarcely match the high-tech hardware now available from the West, leading many state broadcasters and aspiring commercial operators to disenchantment and frustration. Not for Poland's new private station, TV Echo, it translates to, however. This tiny organisation, which has the unique distinction of being the first private enterprise TV station in Eastern Europe, it's proved it can turn out popular and highly watchable programming without a megabucks hardware or programming budget. Located in the provincial capital of Wrocław, the station went on air in February 1990, transmitting general entertainment shows for 6 hours a day over a radius of 70 kilometres. Licensed by Lech Wałęsa's government on an experimental basis, TV Echo's status is due for further official sanction in the near future. TV Echo's transmitter has been supplied by Rohde & Schwarz on a loan basis, no doubt with a view to follow-on sales from other private stations, which it is hoped will follow in Echo's wake. UHF Channel 21 was allocated, hence the transmitter is a model NT228, radiating around 150 watts. The studio and transmitter are on the top floor of a tower block, so the 3/4-inch Heliax feeder to the turnstile antenna is short. While the RF side of the operation is fairly conventional, the video production hardware is highly unorthodox. There is just one studio, separated by glass from the control room. Live programming is shot entirely with two consumer SVHS cameras, one Panasonic and one Grundig. The single mixer is a Panasonic WJ-MX10, and station idents, graphics and test patterns are generated by a Commodore Amiga, running a variety of off-the-shelf art and titling packages. The Amiga comes into its own, thanks to its high-resolution fonts, including all the Polish accents, which can then be keyed through the Panasonic mixer for captioning studio-generated programs. Not all Echo's programming is live. Each night, the station screens sequences from MTV, Sky News and Sky One, using nothing more than an everyday and cheap Amstrad SRX 100 satellite receiver. Much programming is recorded in advance using 5 VHS and 1 SVHS portable machine. Footage is then transferred to U-Matic for editing and played out from a Sony VP7040 machine. Virtually all this equipment was begged or bought at bargain basement prices. The exchange rate means that video hardware costs in real terms 10 times more than the Western European price. On my visit, I was begged to find out if any broadcasters or facilities houses could donate unwanted equipment. Of course, the station would like to upgrade to more professional hardware, but their finances will not permit this until they have become longer established. For all that, the domestic equipment used has proved to be remarkably reliable. It needs to be in a country where spares and official repair facilities are non-existent. The results, too, belie the humble capabilities of the equipment used. They used to say David Bailey could take great pictures even with an Instamatic, and similarly, at Televisia Echo, any lack of picture quality is made up for by the obvious talent of the relatively young program makers. The style of presentation is supremely confident, and that includes the youngsters who present programs for people of their own age. The numerous animated commercials for local businesses made on the irrepressible Amiga put to shame some of those seen on the state's own channel. Much of Echo's appeal is in its alternative style of programming, including open access discussion shows by local residents and a unique fly-on-the-wall show called With the Cops, in which the local police chiefs take Echo's cameras out to the scene of major crimes and road traffic accidents, providing engrossing and exciting on-the-spot reportage, allowing viewers to see how incidents develop from the rescue service's standpoint. Poland is now proposing to license up to 2 non-networked private stations in large cities, so it's likely that more shoestring stations will follow Echo's lead. That was from International Broadcasting.
16 years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields, through High Street Studios, to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalised in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie, Jackie, Jackie.
The station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the vessel of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs.
From houseboats on the River Thames to office blocks in town.
Close enough to really care, as Brent should always be. We're Southwest London's favourite station. Radio Jackie.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts, 6205 and 12255, every Monday and Tuesday, our weekly programme of technical, media and science news.
Items from Radio World. Restructuring Italian radio. Implementation of the broadcast bill in Italy designed to restructure radio broadcasting is in question with a shift in the political climate. A new communications minister has to determine whether the spectrum allocations will remain as initially planned. In compliance with the broadcast bill, more than 4,000 radio stations in Italy have applied for licenses. Only 1,500 are expected to receive them. And also something from Washington about the plans for digital audio broadcasting. Who can shape the policy at WARC? While most countries' spectrum policies for the 1992 World Administrative Radio Conference are yet to be completed and released, there are indications it could become a case of Canada and the United States, along with a few other nations from the Western Hemisphere, trying to influence Eurasian delegates regarding digital audio broadcasting. Canada and the US or at most American broadcasters, want at least some block of spectrum around 1500 MHz, or L-band, for terrestrial DAB. Canada also has targeted the band for both satellite and terrestrial, and satellite interests are lobbying the US position as well. But in Europe, nothing above 860 MHz in the UHF band has even been proposed. Proposals surfaced at an EBU meeting held in Portugal after the NAB convention this spring. Two countries appear to have already settled on the desired bandwidth for DAB. In Germany, television channel 12, 223 to 230 MHz, is being cleared for digital broadcasting, and the Soviet Union has set aside a portion of the FM band, 100 to 108 MHz, for digital radio. France, Sweden, Belgium, Luxembourg, Finland, and the Netherlands have proposed slices of spectrum which they say have a good chance of being set aside for DAB. They are either in the current FM band, the VHF, or UHF television bands. Other countries are eyeing the same bands, but not finalising policy because of the current users, which all countries admit are plentiful. WARC experts in the United States believe many countries will wait for the US position to be made public before structuring their own DAB spectrum policies. Right now, behind the scenes, they are battling it out to wrestle L-band away from military air operations. Those from Radio World.
Once again, it looks like Britain will be left behind. Solar cell conversion. A team from Imperial College in London has developed a new kind of solar cell, which converts light to electricity three times as efficiently as today's panels. Dr. Keith Barnum's group has built and tested a cell based on quantum wells, rather than the commonly used bandgap techniques. Quantum wells have been used by researchers building optical computers. They consist of very small areas of impurities doped into a semiconductor whose atoms have slightly different energy absorption characteristics to the dopant. When light falls into the electrical well, an electron is knocked out. If a stream of electrons is displaced, a current begins to flow. Dr. Barnum has built a test cell consisting of 30 quantum wells and believes that the process has an efficiency of about 40%. Commercial solar cells have efficiencies of between 5 and 25% at the moment.
You've left my ring by the soap. Now is that love? You cleaned me out, you could say broke. Now is that love? The better, better, better it gets, the more these girls forget that that is love. You won't get dressed, you walk about. Now is that the teasing glances push me out? Now is that the tougher, tougher, tougher it gets, the more my lips frequent. Now that is love. Beat me up with your letters, your walk-out notes. Funny how you still find me right here at home. Legs up with a book and a drink. Now is that love that's making you think? I'm not so hot. Now is that love? My assets froze while yours have dropped. Now is that? It's a Cupid, Cupid, Cupid disguise. The more or less survive. Now that is love. Drink. Now is that
that love that's making you think. You made my bed the finger points. Now is that love? The more you cool down, the easier love is found. Now that is love.
No Escape from the Global Telephone in New Scientist by Tim Thwaites. A new global telephone system where users dial people rather than telephone terminals could be into its first phase by 1995, a telecommunications expert told the Australian and New Zealand Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in Adelaide earlier this month. Raj Pandya, director of the University of Adelaide's Teletraffic Research Centre, says that the new system, known as Universal Personal Telecommunications UPT, would allow subscribers to dial direct to a personal telephone number. The global network would automatically divert the call to wherever that person was. By 2005, he said, 40% of such calls would go to portable receivers. Each UPT user would have a personal number, which would allow them to place and receive calls anywhere in the world, using any type of receiver. Calls would be charged automatically to the personal number, rather than to a telephone or line, and the system would allow individuals to determine which calls to accept and which to have diverted to an answering service. The idea of UPT was put forward by Telecom Australia in 1989. Since then, Pandya said, it has been accepted worldwide as the future telecommunication service. Most of the basic technology to put together such a network already exists, but applying it requires more research. The most pressing area is development of a capability to allow verification of a caller. There are three possibilities, he says. The simplest is to punch in a personal identification number, as at an automatic cash machine. Another is to use a programmed chip to generate a unique set of tones in the receiver, which would be analysed by the network. The most sophisticated system would incorporate speech recognition. Among other key issues is the need to ensure personal privacy and how to charge the user equitably. What happens, for example, if the person you're calling next door has unexpectedly gone halfway round the world and the call is rerouted there? That from New Scientist and some other global telephone networks in a moment. In Microwave Journal by Howard Bierman, Communication Satellite Programs. Wireless personal voice and data communications from any part of the Earth to another using a handheld telephone-like device is the goal of Motorola Communications Division as it proceeds with its Iridium program. Each of the 77 satellites will be relatively small in size and packed with sophisticated electronics to contact Earth station gateways and mobile subscriber units. It is aimed at providing service in sparsely populated areas, regions where current terrestrial systems are not available, and in developing countries where there is no existing service. The current cellular telephone system involves a number of fixed or static cells, with mobile users passing from one cell to another. In the Iridium program, the 77 satellites and their projection of cells move 7,400 meters per second, and thus users, even those flying in jets, appear stationary as the cells pass by. The Iridium system consists of the following five major sections. The space segment of 77 satellites hurtling 413 miles above the Earth in seven polar orbital planes. The 20 GHz downlink and the 30 GHz uplink Earth stations acting as gateways to support cell processing operations. A centralized system control facility for satellite constellation control, a launch segment to place the satellites in orbit, and a subscriber link between the user and satellite. The two networks involved are the subscriber network with up and down links centered at 1.6 GHz and the trunk and control network. For the system to function with handheld, low-power antennas, each satellite must produce 37 fixed high-gain spot beams at the L-band. Each beam or cell must employ a different level of gain and power determined by the varying range of the satellites. Using a 7-cell frequency reuse pattern, cells are scanned by the satellite antenna arrays with a specific time pattern and sequence. Each of the scanning satellite beam antennas is programmed to aim the correct cell on the Earth at a set time. Within each cell, the uplink's frequency channels are 126 kHz wide and spaced every 160 kHz. To optimize operation, the downlink uses a 2.2:1 digital speech compression ratio so that 25 carriers can handle up to 55 voice channels. Inter-satellite crosslinks are formed as each satellite communicates and routes network traffic to the two satellites before and after the vehicle in each orbital plane using fixed waveguide slot antennas. Satellites in adjacent orbital planes are interconnected using mechanically steered antennas. The design for the handheld subscriber unit calls for weight less than 0.6 of a kilogram and 24-hour operation in standby mode from a single battery charge. A look at a very complex satellite telephone communications network for the future in Microwave Journal.
Thank you. you made. Remember the promise you made.
Remember the promise you made. Remember the promise you made.
Optimizing in-car audio equipment is a complex engineering process. Jeff Howard, in car design and technology, visits Ford's sound laboratory at Dunton to find out how it's done. It's 5 years now since Ford started to get really serious about its own brand factory fit audio systems by dedicating a special department in its European electrical and electronics operations to the task of developing new in-car entertainment products and by investing heavily in advanced test facilities. More recently, it has started building its own $120 million audio equipment manufacturing plant at Setúbal near Lisbon. 2 years ago, Ford opened a new electronics technical centre at Dunton alongside the existing design and engineering buildings, which form the hub of European product development. As the only major European car manufacturer to design, develop and assemble its own audio equipment, Ford operates many unique test facilities, including one of the largest anechoic chambers for radio frequency interference evaluation in the world, and an advanced sound laboratory big enough to take two complete vehicles and fitted out with the latest digital analysis equipment for recording and assessing in-car systems. The building also contains audio system design offices with CAD terminals linked to the Ford Worldwide Computer Network, plus other electronics departments working on engine management systems, spark plugs, fuel pumps and sender units, pressure, temperature and fluid level sensors, electronic instrumentation and vehicle control systems. The sound laboratory is housed in a sealed chamber containing a large workspace and a special anechoic speaker evaluation room. Complete cars can be assessed here for the quality of their in-car audio system, from basic radio reception through to a full spectrum analysis of the sound frequencies actually reaching the occupant's ears. The separate anechoic RFI chamber alongside allows cars to be rotated for antenna performance evaluation or operated with their engines running to investigate any in-vehicle interference sources and develop suppression systems. Both chambers include short-range radio transmission equipment to reproduce real-world characteristics. Although Ford is seldom thought of as a major audio producer, its North American operations actually rates as the second largest company in the car audio business worldwide. All Ford models in Europe are currently sold with Ford-produced radio cassette, power amplifiers, and graphic equalizer systems, with speakers supplied from outside and CD players produced by licensing arrangements with Sony. In the sound laboratory, a band of pink noise is transmitted on radio frequencies at short range to the car under evaluation. It is received via the standard antenna, passed through the radio and amplifier to the speakers, where the voltage response is compared with the transmitted trace. That forms a simple measure of the performance of the electrical elements in the audio system. For acoustic appraisal, an array of 6 microphones is installed around typical ear positions in the car, and the sound levels scanned, so that mean values of sound pressure can also be compared with the transmitted trace. The localized difference between what leaves the transmitter and what reaches the listener show the parts of the range where there are deficiencies, without getting into the subjective business of jury panels and personal audio tastes. The next stage in development used to involve an anthropomorphic half-dummy dubbed Van Gogh, with a pair of high-precision directional microphones installed in its ear positions and complete with fully shaped and representatively tactile removable plastic ears, as supplied in pairs in 3 different sizes. This has now been replaced by a more advanced head acoustic mannequin with half-inch Bruhl & Kerr high-precision condenser microphones in its ears and a battery of processing equipment in its chest. The music program from the audio equipment on test in the vehicle is picked up in the dummy's ears and digitally recorded, so that listening panels in the future can compare exactly the same sounds through electrostatic headphones without the distractions of seating position or personal conversation, and without the distraction of changing vehicles or waiting for engineering modifications. By synchronizing two digital audio tape players to the same transmitted soundtrack, the technique allows comparison between cars and systems to be made by instantaneous A-B switching. Ford is well aware that personal taste is a major factor in audio assessment, so listening panels are used only to assess the measure of system or feature differences, never whether sound A is better or worse than sound B. Scientific evidence alone determines which system has superior performance. From the days when standard fit radios were only very basic units operating under severe installation constraints, Ford has developed a wide range of premium audio equipment which can compete with some of the best systems available in the aftermarket. Small speakers tucked away in footwells producing muffled sounds from cheap tuners and low-power amplifiers have given way to advanced high-power optimized systems integrated with the vehicle design from the earliest stages of new vehicle development. New models, such as the latest Escort, have their speakers installed high up the front door trims, capable of producing very high quality sound with separate coaxial tweeters, and 4 20-watt channels of low distortion power standard on gear versions, and optional on the other models of car. In the special anechoic speaker assessment room, an array of suspended microphones is used to determine the off-axis performance of new products under development, so that all variables likely to affect the installed performance can be eliminated before in-vehicle trials commence. The effects of speaker trim covers and even whole door panels can be assessed here if required. Integrating large speakers into the wrap-round styling of latest models often produces design conflicts, which can only be resolved by detailed evaluation of audio performance. Ford believes that vehicle electronics have reached the threshold of a new era, which will be characterized by the arrival of totally new integrated electrical and electronic systems. During the 1990s, designers will begin to escape from simply replacing mechanical functions with solid-state devices and their previous practice of merely adding on features to existing equipment. Total systems will have greater flexibility and adaptability, with extensive software control of multifunction features. In the field of audio equipment, Ford predicts that the demand for premium systems, which started in the 1970s, will continue to grow. By the year 2000, fully automatic equalizing systems will become available, capable of delivering high-quality sound to all seating positions in the car, regardless of the number of passengers being carried. Audio displays will be integrated and shared with other information units, such as the instrumentation, trip computer, climate controls, and navigational aids, bringing them nearer to the driver's main sight line so there is less risk of being distracted. More specifically, there are moves towards separating the bass frequencies from the main speakers and providing dedicated subwoofer systems in the rear. This arrangement would allow door speakers to operate in the sealed enclosures, improving efficiencies, eliminating many resonance concerns, and providing greatly enhanced bass response. To package the 10-litre enclosures required for a typical subwoofer system in a European-sized car, a moulding housing possibly with two separate drive units would probably be needed. The subwoofer chamber for special sound systems available in the United States on the Lincoln Town Car is molded to fit into the voids around the spare wheel well. Ford already offers such super sound systems on many of its North American products, and an offline Thunderbird equipped with this option is all currently at Dunton for appraisal. It is estimated that such equipment, when factory fitted in large volumes, costs around 50% more than the premium sound system fitted to a Ford Scorpio today. Subwoofer systems available from aftermarket audio specialists such as Alpine Philips and Pioneer need separate high-power amplifiers up to 300 watts, bypass filters to separate out the bass frequencies, and special speakers up to 16 or even 20 inches in diameter. The sheer bulk of these units and the rigid support panels they require take up quite large volumes of boot space, even before the sealed enclosures are added. Although some of the equipment available has been designed to fit under the front seats in areas not needed for any other purpose. All About Car Audio Systems there by Jeff Howard. Attention, Vega Salina owners.
The other day, in fact yesterday, I was messing about with one of my receivers, i.e. a Vega Salina 215, which you might have, and you might be interested in this technical advice. If you open up the back of your Vega Salina 215, and you look where the band switch is, you'll notice there's three trimmers. Now, would you believe, if you trim those trimmers with a screwdriver, you can actually peak the signal of any station, much more so. I actually did it yesterday while I was listening to Radio Orion, and peaked it almost twice as strong. So as I say, if you've got a Vega Selena and you haven't got any other radio, you can probably get a lot more out of it, and all you have to do is open up the back and adjust the trimmers, and you'll notice that the strength comes up incredibly. But I better give a safety warning: when you take the back off one of these Vega Selenas, make sure that you use a screwdriver with a plastic handle, which sounds like a tough thing to say, but people do make mistakes. Make sure you don't touch metal or anything like that. Make sure you keep your hand on the plastic screwdriver. We all want you electrocuted, would we? And also, don't forget that I'm not too sure if by doing this you unbalance any of the other circuitry. I don't think you do. But if you're slightly technical, you might be interested in that. And I say, it's incredible how much the signal peaks up. It's quite amazing. So there you go, give it a go if you've got one of those Vega Selenas. I would basically say that Orion was twice as strong yesterday afternoon after I'd done this.
Tuning tips there from Radio Confusion, talking about Radio Orion, one of the strongest signals frequently to be heard on 6290. Another tuning tip: if you have a small portable radio, if you attach a long wire to the thing, it usually suffers from severe overload and the front end becomes detuned by the attachment of the long wire aerial. One of the best tricks, if you haven't already discovered it, is to stand it on a sheet of aluminium foil or a commonly available large metal object which might form a better ground, is a radiator. So if you tuck your radio into the top of the radiator, the few picofarads of capacity onto the radiator form a better ground plane, and the radio generally maintains its selectivity but picks up better signals.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and 4 stars in the Radio Netherland receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477, or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
Apple Computer recently announced its most powerful microcomputers and a line of notebook computers produced with the help of Sony. The new top-end Macintosh computers are called the Quadra 700 and 900 and feature Motorola 68040 microprocessors running at 25 MHz. The Quadra systems will run more than 80% faster than the current high-end Macintosh 2FX. Apple's new notebook computers are called PowerBooks, and there are 3 models. They feature a trackball instead of a mouse, and are the first commercial systems to use pseudo-static RAM known as TSOPs, or TSOPs, which allow several megabytes of storage to be contained in tiny add-on cards not much larger than 2 postage stamps.
That's the deal.
Do it, yeah. Go ahead, begin it.
The Churchill Tapes, Are They Genuine? By Barry Fox in Studio Sound. Heated correspondence in the Guardian newspaper earlier this year brought an old audio dispute out into the open again. Are the world-famous recordings of Winston Churchill's speeches really of Churchill? Or were at least some of them made by an impersonator? This is not a nitpicking issue. Winston Churchill's wartime speeches are generally accepted to represent some of the best oratory ever recorded. Historians analyse them. Discs and tapes have been sold to the public round the world for nearly 30 years. They have been wonderful money spinners for Decca and now EMI. The recordings have many times been used in films and radio and television programmes. But 15 years ago, Norman Shelley, an actor famous for his BBC Children's Hour broadcasts, claimed to have made the recordings in place of Churchill. Shelley's claim has since been reported several times and received reasonably wide coverage. But no warning has ever been given to people who buy or use the recordings. Neither the announcer on the recordings nor the biographical sleeve notes even suggest that some of the speeches may have been recorded by an impersonator or by Churchill at later dates. Both Shelley and Churchill are long dead and cannot set the record straight. The correspondence in The Guardian generated conflicting claims and counterclaims. Quite simply, no one now knows who they are listening to or when it was recorded. The record companies involved in releasing the material have adopted a singularly cavalier attitude to historical accuracy. Unhappily for the record companies, but happily for their customers, it looks as if speech experts at Sensimetrics in Cambridge, Massachusetts, have finally discovered the truth. They have been using Churchill's speeches to test the power of new technology designed to analyse speech and check the forensic pedigree of tapes brought to court as evidence. In May, Sensimetrics completed several months' work on 20 of Churchill's speeches. Their results support Shelley's claim and contradict public reassurances of pedigree recently volunteered by the BBC. The analysis also supports belief that some of the recordings made by Churchill have been heavily doctored with artificial echo to create the false impression that they were made in Parliament during the war, when in fact they were made years later in a small room in Chartwell. The record companies can no longer afford to play ostrich. Even if they do not take action voluntarily, members of the public are likely now to complain to trading standards officers about the record labelling. I already have, following failure of First Decca and now EMI to make any useful comment. In 1964, the Decca Record Company issued a set of LP records labelled The Voice of Winston Churchill, authorised by Sir Winston Churchill. In 1983, Decca's subsidiary Argo re-released them on cassettes. These were sold in record shops and by the Imperial War Museum. When PolyGram bought Decca, EMI took an exclusive license to sell the Argo recordings on the EMI Music for Pleasure label. EMI is now selling the Churchill cassettes widely. At the MIDEM International Music Industry Festival held in Cannes earlier this year, record company Thames Distributors promised a digital CD version of the same recordings this spring. At Cannes, Thames said they knew nothing of the pedigree dispute, and it was, quote, Argo's problem, not ours. Although Churchill made broadcasts and 78 RPM disc recordings for the BBC in London during the war, no recording was allowed in the House of Commons. But recordings of his parliamentary speeches appear on the commercial releases. In the 1970s, Norman Shelley broke silence and told what happened after Churchill made his rallying speech on June 4, 1940, at the time of the Dunkirk disaster. He spoke on a television chat show and mentioned in passing that he had recorded the speech for Churchill. I followed through by phoning his agent, who put me on to Shelley. I spoke with him by phone and wrote the story in a Hi-Fi magazine in 1977. Shelley told me how the British Council wanted to send a recording of the Dunkirk speech to the United States for broadcast to generate support there too. Churchill told the Council that he was too busy to go into a studio and record it, but an actor fellow could do it as long as he approved the voice. Shelley recorded a test and later recalled how Churchill listened and gave approval. "Very good. He's even got my teeth," Churchill told the Council. Shelley also recalled how he then went on to do more impersonations. "I heard all this firsthand from Shelley." The BBC later confirmed that Shelley did indeed record the Dunkirk speech in the Transcription Service studios near Regent's Park, but said recently that Churchill made his own re-recording for Decca in 1949 at Chartwell. At the same time, he recorded other missing parliamentary speeches. But on the Argo releases, these sound as if they were made in a large hall, like Parliament, not in a small room. Robert Berkowitz of Sensimetrics was previously with Dolby Laboratories and Acoustic Research. He has always been fascinated by the Churchill tapes. Sensimetrics currently work for the United States government's National Institutes of Health on computer speech synthesis and analysis. They have developed a PC-based analysis system called Speech Station, which uses a radically new method of speech analysis. Conventional analysis of speech tabulates the energy at different frequencies, but variations in the talker's health or mood, the weather, the technical quality of the recording, and the room acoustic can all colour the sound too much to make such measures reliable as a so-called voice print. For Speech Station, Sensimetrics looked for a speech characteristic that is more stable and difficult to disguise. Humans produce the vowels of speech by expelling air through the glottis, a slit between two folds of tissue stretched across the path from the lungs to the throat. Air forced through the slit causes the tissue to vibrate with a buzzing sound, which is rich in harmonics, spread over a wide range of frequencies. These excite resonances called formants in the vocal tract, shaped by the tongue, lips, and jaw. Typically, there are three or four formants, all below 3.5 kHz. These are enough to make speech clearly intelligible even over telephone lines of limited audio fidelity. The formant frequencies do not vary greatly between individuals, but the patterns in which they are combined reflect individual speech habits. There are always two or three formants at the same time during a vowel, and formant patterning is relatively immune from coloration. So, for Speech Station, Sensimetrics adopted the approach of statistically analysing how often certain combinations of formants occur during speech. The system, hardware and software, for use with a PC costing around $2,000, converts analogue speech into digital code and analyses the code 50 times a second, faster than formants are produced, to identify the formant frequencies. Then, the formant combinations are plotted by frequency on a graph. The first formant frequency plotted against the second, and the second against the third. As each Churchill speech lasts 8 or 9 minutes, many thousands of dots accumulate during each plot, forming clusters or clouds, where pairs of formants appear most frequently. The computer sorts the dots into boxes, 125 Hz square, and adds colour to represent cloud density, yellow for high density and blue for low density. The result is a coloured patch pattern on the computer screen, which shows how often the talker uses certain tongue, lip and jaw configurations. there is very little chance that the clouds generated over a period of minutes by one talker will match the clouds generated by another. 5 of the 20 speeches Sensemetrics analysed were recorded on public occasions, for example, after-dinner speeches, and can thus be taken as a reference for Churchill's genuine voice. The other 15 were obviously made without an audience and are thus suspect. The formant concentrations on 12 of these match the reference recordings, but on the other 3, the patterns are quite different.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax 6205 and 12255, presented this week by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. Fresh Radio Fax programmes start on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. If you'd like to write to us, our address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. I look forward very much to your letter and guarantee to read it out on air. If you'd like a reply in writing to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence. 3 international reply coupons or $1. The address again, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. One such letter comes all the way from Finland, from Bengt Renman, writing from Vantaa. He writes, I'm 57 years old and I began DXing in the year 1952. I enjoyed listening to your station, many thanks. He was listening on 6205 and he's got a Kenwood R5000 with a 50 metre long wire aerial.
Continuing with the story about the authenticity of Churchill's wartime recordings. And we've heard how 3 recordings are suspect. All 3 alien recordings are of speeches originally made in Parliament in 1940. One is the speech Churchill made in Parliament on May the 13th, when he became Prime Minister and promised the nation nothing but blood, toil, tears and sweat. Another is Their Finest Hour of June the 18th, when he predicted the Battle of Britain and warned of a new dark age for Europe and the US if Germany won. The third is the most famous of all Churchill's speeches, the Dunkirk rallying call, a colossal military disaster, which was made on June the 4th, 1940, and contains the oft-quoted pledge, we shall fight on the beaches, in the fields, in the streets, and in the hills. The announcer on the recording variously introduces these speeches as Winston Churchill's speech to the House of Commons, here is his speech, and a speech to the House of Commons. The sleeve note carries a picture of Churchill and the title, Winston Churchill, a selection of his wartime speeches. The analysis now done by Sensemetrics clearly suggests that when people listen to these 3 speeches, they are unwittingly listening to an impersonation, almost certainly by Norman Shelley. The question must now be asked, how can the fake recordings have survived so long without complaints from customers, historians, and program producers who use them? Even if people believe that the parliamentary speeches were recorded live in the House of Commons, perhaps as a result of some special wartime dispensation, there is none of the characteristic background sound of a debate. Artificial echo is a very poor substitute. Also, the voices on the alien speeches sound different to the casual listener, because in many respects the human ear is still the fastest, most wide-ranging and accurate analytical tool. But the more and the closer you listen to the recordings, the more confusing it gets. Churchill's voice changes significantly over the 5-year period of the war, charting the physical toll on the man. And Shelley does a remarkable impersonation, complete with traits and mannerisms. Decker's role in all this has been far from exemplary. The BBC only has documentary evidence to support the pedigree of the broadcasts that Churchill recorded on 78 RPM discs. But when Decca released the speeches on cassette on the Argo label in 1983, the sleeve notes described them as historic recordings taken from radio transcriptions dating from 1939 to 1945. The BBC acknowledged that Norman Shelley recorded his impersonation of the Dunkirk speech in 1940 for the British Council at the BBC's old transcription service studios near Regent's Park. But the BBC have always believed that all the parliamentary speeches issued for commercial use were private recordings made later by Churchill at Chartwell. In 1984, after I had published articles and made broadcasts questioning the role of Shelley, the BBC asked Decca to stop implying that all their commercial releases were sourced from the BBC, when the parliamentary speeches were not. The BBC have since then worked on the assumption that all these, including Dunkirk, were recorded after the war at Chartwell. By neat but clearly unplanned timing, Argo's release of the Churchill cassettes had coincided with the release by Argo of Norman Shelley reading A.A. Milne's Winnie the Pooh and House at Pooh Corner. Significantly, the record companies did not respond to the correspondence that appeared in the Guardian newspaper while Sensimetrics were working on the tapes. This followed from a reader's letter in April 1991. The reader thought that Ralph Truman, an actor with the BBC Repertory Company, had recorded Churchill's speeches. David Irving, author of a biography of Churchill, replied and told how Shelley had confirmed to him that several times in 1940, millions of radio listeners were tricked into believing that they were hearing Churchill's voice, when in fact it was Shelley's. Irving says he rechecked with Shelley when Martin Gilbert, another Churchill biographer, refuted Shelley's claim. Sally Hine of the BBC's Sound Archives irritated the original questioner when she wrote that Shelley's recording was not really an impersonation, simply an actor reading in Churchill's style. Several myths have arisen. It has now even been suggested that most of Churchill's war broadcasts were made by Shelley. Here, in the archive at the BBC, we have watched this story grow with great interest and some irritation. Sally Hine was clearly distressed to hear the results of forensic analysis. "You're joking," she exclaimed. "This just goes round in circles. What I wrote was what we at the archives believed and still believe. But we only have documentary evidence on the broadcast recordings we supplied to Decca. We have always referred queries on the Dunkirk speech to Decca." In 1985, the BBC issued a compact disc dealing generally with the war years, CD 3005, and this includes excerpts from some of Churchill's speeches. Although the CD is hard to find, the BBC helpfully supplied Berkowitz with a taped copy. He has now compared these speeches, which appear in excerpted form on the BBC CD and in fuller form on the Decca EMI releases. At least two speeches, Their Finest Hour and The First Year, are entirely different. The BBC's versions are almost certainly Churchill's later re-recordings. So the BBC's reassurances on the pedigree of the Decca EMI releases lose credibility. Surely EMI now have a clear duty to burrow into Decca's files and look for dates and authentication of these money-spinning releases. If there is no clear documentary proof that all the recordings were made by Churchill himself, EMI are surely now morally and legally obligated to put warning stickers on all product in the shops. The narration on the recordings should also be re-edited to make it clear that some of the speeches cannot possibly have been recorded on the dates given. At the same time, it would make sense to remove the appalling artificial echo which Decca added to Churchill's original historic recordings. That piece, all about the authenticity of Churchill's recordings of speeches, by Barry Fox in Studio Sound. So where are the sound engineers who were there when those recordings were made? Some of them must still be alive. They'll know exactly who recorded what.